this evening.
And there's just a good amount of self-charge for your evening. And he has been ordained at San Francisco Zen Center since 1994. Started practicing in 1988, that's right.
Something like that, I think. Yeah, maybe 89.
Trained in Osaka, trained in Japan at the Kokujin Monastery. And I think you were the founder of No Abode.
Well, I think Reb is officially the founder, but I was the first to live there. You can call me Luminous or Owl or Luminous Owl or anything else you'd like.
Welcome.
Thank you. It's a beautiful Zendo and Zen Center here. So I thought I might bring up some contemplations to motivate practice, some reflections to increase our motivation for practice. Because we probably all have times when we can't quite remember why we're doing it, or there's not so much energy there. We're just kind of going through the motions. I know I have these times, these kind of dry spells in practice, and there's various contemplations or reflections that I find really useful to remember the motivation that's actually already here to practice. They kind of turn the mind toward Dharma and toward practice. So the first to mention is the rarity of human life. How rare it is to be born a human being. It's, again, so easy to take for granted. And of course, we're a human being. What else would we be? But to really actually contemplate that and remember the amazing gift it is to be a human being. And so traditionally, the Buddha said that in all these various realms of sentient beings, like we know of the animal realm, but then there's also the, you know, heaven realms and hell realms and hungry ghost realms and God realms and so on. But even of the good and bad realms that we could be born in, the human realm is the one kind of being that can actually realize the way and become a Buddha. And sometimes we might say, well, isn't that kind of biased? Or what, isn't that kind of saying that, kind of disparaging animals, for example? Like, can't they become Buddha too? But you could say, well, the animals aren't capable or something, but in another way to look at it that's maybe less disparaging is just that they don't have as many problems as we do. They don't need to practice in the same way that humans do. I think humans, I don't know, it could be argued that animals suffer more than humans, but it's in different ways, I think. But we have all these, so many complex internal, mental, spiritual, emotional difficulties that I think other realms of sentient beings don't have. But also, we have this potential. We have this incredible intelligence as human beings, and a mind capable of understanding the teachings of the Buddha. So to be born a human being, actually the Buddha had this metaphor for how rare it is to be born a human being. Of, it's like there's a piece of wood floating in the ocean with a hole in the middle, and floating in maybe all the oceans of the world. And then in all the oceans of the world, there's this one blind sea turtle living under the ocean. And so the chances of this blind sea turtle coming up to the surface and putting its head through the hole in the wood in all the vast oceans, it's apparently more rare than that to be born a human being. So it's kind of a strange metaphor, you know, but maybe memorable. So we think, well, there's all these humans. Just look at all these humans. But if you start counting the ants, for example, many more ants, not to mention all these other invisible beings, in the kind of, you know, Buddhist cosmology, if you go for that. But even if you don't, just the fact that to be born at all, right, is, we don't even know what this is. I mean, this miraculous gift of a human life that we're just given. It comes to us, and here we are, and it's, you know, it's so easily wasted, right? And even as practitioners, so this is, you know, you could take this reflection of the rarity of human life even further to say that not only were we born human, but we have basically most of our sense faculties are functioning, you know, maybe some aren't working as well as others, but we can, as we say in the chant, you know, the Dharma is here to see and listen to. We have these, we have eyes and ears, and a mind that can fully functioning. You know, maybe we say, well, my senses aren't functioning as well as they could, but still, this is, we have all we need. Everyone in this room has all they need. To see and hear Dharma. And not only are we born with human life, with all these sense faculties basically working, but we've heard about, you know, we've come in contact, at least in some way, with these incredible, profound teachings of liberation in this life. And I don't really know people here. Maybe people are coming for the first time to the Zen Center and haven't heard any of the Buddha's teachings at all, but you made it here, you know, at the very least. So there's this potential in the Buddha's and the ancestors' teachings for this complete freedom and happiness, and to actually make it as far as like sitting in a zendo is like. You take how rare it is to be a human being, and then amongst those human beings, how many make it that far? That's getting really, really rare. And then if you even have the slightest bit of faith and trust in the teachings, that's even more rare, right? So then to get that far, right, that rarity, that's maybe like, you know, the percentage of people in the universe of beings in the universe who have a human life or with sense faculties basically intact, you know, have heard about teachings of liberation, whether or not they're Buddhist teachings, but just the possibility to be free, and then, you know, have you know, born in a land where we can hear these teachings. Incredibly rare and wonderful gift. So just to reflect on that, to contemplate that, I know for me, just to briefly even contemplate that often will wake me up from a stupor of forgetting why I practice or thinking it doesn't really matter. So you can see how this is a motivation for practice, just to remember how rare the gift is. And we just, you know, naturally we don't want to waste it, right? It's so easy to waste. Because then the next reflection The second one, after the rarity of this human life, is the impermanence of this human life. So how it's almost like the other side of the first one, in a way, right? The first is, how wonderful, amazing this gift. But wait a second, it's quickly passing. So this could sound... this could be disturbing, right? Or sound maybe depressing even, that we don't want to contemplate the impermanence of our life. And maybe we'll even just get anxious or worried or depressed. But I think, I find actually it's encouraging, enlivening actually to contemplate impermanence, especially combined with this first one, the gift. Amazing, rare gift, but like, it's quickly passing, so let's really live each moment. So the Buddha said that to contemplate impermanence, you can think that death is certain to come to all of us. Death is certain to come to every one of us. Within 100 years, this is kind of an intense thought, I think. Within 100 years, everyone in this room will not be alive. Right? Death is certain to come. It will come to every one of us. And when it comes is not certain. It could come at any moment. Right? We can't count on it, no matter how healthy we are. It could come at any moment. And at that time, the Dharma and our practice will be the only help at that time. So we can contemplate that. Other things can, you know, be a wonderful comfort and aid to us at that time, family and friends and so on, but really ultimately at the moment of actually entering death, the only thing we can take with us, you could say, or that really can actually help us at that time is the teachings of what this life and this death is, and our practice up to that point. Some people would say that all our practice while we're alive is just preparing us for this moment of death. So I remember when I was young, in my hometown, there was a big cemetery. I remember driving by in the back of the car, and just several minutes of driving by these gravestones. Right, and the parents in the car wouldn't really notice. It was just in the middle of town, you just always drive by it, but it would strike me, like, wow, all these people used to be alive, and now they're not. And it wasn't, I can remember the feeling as a kid that I actually felt encouraged by it, in this very way of this reflection of, wow, all these people were once alive and they're not now, and I'm alive. It kind of reminded me of the gift. Wow, what is this that I'm here looking at them, have this mind that in this awareness that can be experiencing this life at this moment, and those are all markers for that's over for all those people. And so again, encouragement to really practice whatever that may be. Hopefully we'll get to this. I remember this temple I was at in Japan, at the entrance to their, you know, all the temples in Japan have a cemetery, graveyard of temple donors and so on next to them. And they had this big stone marker at the entrance to the graveyard that had this kind of poetic verse in Japanese that was like, we were once like you are now. You will one day be like us. And just as walking into the graveyard for walking meditation or whatever, it would really hit home to remember that. So another contemplation is contemplating the effects of our actions. So everything that we do, body, speech, and mind, has some effect. The smallest, any kind of motivational activity that we do, is basically anything we do. Every action has an effect. So if they're in the direction of distraction from practice, or turning away from practice, or in this kind of, or, you know, harmful to ourselves or others, activities that are coming from that motivation have that effect. You know, we know there's certain activities that get turn us away from practice, and then there's all kinds of activities of body, speech, and mind that turn us towards remembering practice and presence and being awake and alive and appreciating this gift of this rare human life. So to just contemplate how all our actions throughout the day are either turning us towards or away from practice is another helpful motivator, I find. And another one is contemplating dissatisfaction, discontent. So this is the big one, right? This is like the first noble truth in the Buddha Dharma. Whether we call it all-out, full-blown suffering and total despair, or even just going through the day with just something just feels off, you know, something, things aren't as harmonious as they could be in my life or in the world or in this mind. some discontent, and in the Buddha's teaching it's said that actually until awakening every moment is permeated with at least some slight nuance of discontent, if not a lot. So even in pleasure, there's in the back of our mind, there's some thought, usually maybe even unconsciously or subconsciously, that, well, it's going to end, and there's a little bit of holding on to it and a little worry that, or discontent that it's not going to last forever. So again, not to be depressing or as kind of like that, why would I want to think about discontent? But as a motivator to just notice if that feeling, that kind of pervading, continuous sense that something seems a little off or way off, is this motivator to like actually become free of that. Because finally the fifth contemplation, so the first four are contemplating the rarity of this human life, the impermanence of this human life, the effect of all our actions, and a discontent or dissatisfaction with this human life. And then the fifth is the potential for liberation, the potential to be free of all discontent, and for all beings to be free from discontent and dissatisfaction. That's the really positive one, right? But I think it's in the context of all these contemplations working together. You know, that if we don't notice discontent, then we're not, maybe we don't really care about being free from discontent, because what's the discontent? But if we kind of really tune in to like where something feels off, and then remember this incredibly important teaching, which is, I think, you know, the whole point of the Four Noble Truths and this first truth of human suffering, is that there is this potential to be free. We really, this is possible. And to remember this. I think if we don't remember that one, we will lose our motivation for practice and we'll become discouraged. And, so And maybe we don't quite believe that there's this potential to really be free. So this is something to reflect on. If we have some doubt that this is possible, to somehow clarify this doubt. And this clarification of this doubt is practice, or is one aspect of practice. So we kind of need the motivation to practice, which is this trust that this liberation is possible, but yet practice develops the trust. So they do kind of go together. And but in some sense, you could say to even be in a room where you're hearing about practice at all, there's already a little bit of trust, if not a lot. So whatever that little bit is, to use that and turn that towards opening to deeper trust. In some ways, I've often thought that practice is actually just deepening trust. And even realization or awakening could be said to be the point of complete trust or complete conviction in Dharma, the end of doubt. Over the past year, I've been studying some of the Xin Xin Ming, the trusting mind, and I think that maybe you've been looking at that here too, at Santa Cruz. And so this, you could say faith in mind or trust in mind, or it's the song of the trusting mind. So this there's one line in the poem that says, trust mind not to. So it could be translated as, trust or faith and mind are not to, or, the trusting mind of non-duality, or you could read it as trust the mind of non-duality. So this could be the definition of practice and realization, which for our school of Zen are not two either, practice and realization, is trusting the mind of non-duality. The mind of non-duality where there's no separate subject and object, there's no separate experiencer and experienced, and the non-duality ultimately of this discontent and the freedom from the discontent. So part of that trust is trusting that the discontent and the complete liberation are not so far apart, not very far apart at all. I think this is where we can sometimes get discouraged and think, well, this is potential for freedom from the suffering, but not for me. You know, it's too much work. It's impossible. But entrusting this mind of non-duality more and more deeply, we can open to that potential. So sometimes at the beginning of a period of zazen, especially after a busy day, sitting down in the zendo, and like the mind's just reviewing the busy day and just continuing, I often use just this motivational kind of phrase, like contemplating the rarity, impermanence, dissatisfaction, and and liberative potential of human life, I now just sit, or whatever the practice may be. And it just, it you know, turns the mind towards the motivation. And it can't be done in a rote way. It can't be done in a kind of mechanical thing, day after day, just saying the phrase, just like all these chants that we do, taking refuge in Buddha and so on, and these vows that we chant. It's so easy to do them in a rote way without really thinking about them, but to slow down enough to really, each contemplation, to actually, almost like you can feel, actually, an internal shift. Contemplating the rarity of human life, and like, you know, not just the words, but like tune into that. Oh yeah, you can almost feel like just energy arising. How rare this life is, how quickly passing. At the same time, it's almost like those two balance each other, and then the dissatisfaction, and that yet this great potential for the liberation from the dissatisfaction are also like a pair. They kind of balance each other, work together, and then the how every action has an effect is kind of the context for the whole thing. In the midst of all that, like every thought, action, and word is turning us towards or away from this freedom. And without getting fully into it, another word about this freedom is, and the dissatisfaction, this turning point, that's the kind of crux of practice, one could say, which includes the freedom and dissatisfaction for all beings. So it's a vast scale project working on this turning point for ourselves and all beings. It all seems to revolve. I deeply am convinced that it all seems to revolve around this issue of what is the self? Who is this self? And who do we believe this is? Which seems to be the root of the dissatisfaction, and understanding who this is seems to be the freedom from the dissatisfaction. Who is this person in relation to the universe at its very core? And so this is a kind of meditation too, there's just sitting, and this could be a form of just sitting, is deeply investigating who is this. It seems to all rotate and turn around this point. For example, when there's great dissatisfaction, when being really caught in something, to notice who is this at that point. There is who do I feel or think I am at those moments when they're happening? You can ask that, and also at the times when you actually feel quite free and flowing along with the universe quite contentedly, at that time too, one could ask, who do I feel or think I am at the most deepest level at that time? Seems to be a fruitful meditation. So that's a bunch of stuff to think about and contemplate. But I think particularly these mind-changing contemplations are something that's often not brought up in Zen practice, but I've found for myself such reflections to be really useful, especially at the times of doubt or laziness or turning away from practice or just not remembering why to bother. So does anyone have anything in relation to all this or not to bring up? Because I've heard these teachings about this self, I look to that place of that there seems to be, and it does. My experience seems to confirm these teachings that there seems to be this independently existing, kind of separate, kind of solidified sense of self at those times. That also I know by studying the teachings that it really doesn't make sense. That one, really, according to Dharma, is really a complete illusion, but yet it feels so real. So I think that's really useful too at the times when it when we feel that contraction, which is related, I think, to the dissatisfaction. There's some contraction into the small self, I'd say virtually always. And if there's discontent or dissatisfaction, there's on some level, I would propose that this belief or view of this independently existing self is operating at that time, and so it's this great opportunity when there's dissatisfaction to look for that hidden, usually quite hidden, actually. It's not a revealed view or belief. It's so deeply entrenched. But to see that actually this is my feeling right now is, and whole experience is based on this false view. And then to start investigating how that view doesn't hold up, in reality, how it actually doesn't make sense. The way the universe works, that there would be this independently existing person that doesn't depend on anything else in the interdependent universe. But yeah, I think it's particularly useful when the dissatisfaction is actually arising to start investigating that. Because that's one of the motivations, right? This contemplating dissatisfaction is one of the motivations for this practice. I think when things are going really well, everything's kind of just going along smoothly, we're not as motivated to actually investigate. I'd say the sense of this independent self is still operating even when things are going along quite well, but we're not so motivated to investigate it, where we could be then really free, even when free of things going well, in the midst of things going well. Yes.
Because for myself, when I start to examine a lot of these ideas, trust in mind seems like an oxymoron for me. But, you know, I have so many beliefs and thoughts that I have thought were true, and when I sit with them,
Yeah, well, I think this is trust the mind of non-duality.
Right.
So that's not the kind of conceptual, caught up in thinking and beliefs mind necessarily. Trust the mind of non-duality, because actually the mind is not a problem in itself. The mind is just could be just spacious awareness that's not all the, you know, caught in judgments of this and that and so on. But also, the mind of non-duality could be said to be, even when there's the judgments of this and that and so on, that they're, that to understand that those, that kind of conceptual, caught, contracted kind of mind is actually, just the workings of the whole universe. So that in that way it's, and that mind, that the churning, disturbed mind is actually in complete harmony with everything. Could be another way to, trust this mind of non-duality. Do you follow that?
It doesn't feel like it's in harmony.
But to, then even to take that, the feeling of it not being in harmony, and to trust through some understanding of how this could be so, that because everything is perfectly in accord with everything, by definition, according to Dharma, right, that actually even the feeling of like, this couldn't be the mind of non-duality, that very thought or feeling is itself completely in harmonious accord with everything, inconceivably maybe, but can we trust that? Can we trust that's the mind of non-duality, that the mind of duality and non-duality are not two? And I think that this trust is not blind faith either, and it's not just because some ancestor said it. We have to investigate how it's so. The trust, how does the trust come? It comes partly from investigation and partly from zazen. Zazen is a kind of investigation, but without even the investigative part of zazen, but just wholeheartedly sit and thus drop off body and mind, also develops a deep trust. And that's the inconceivable one, that just sitting where on some level there is that trust that this sitting is in accord with the universe. And then there's teachings about that too. Yes.
And for those people who don't experience harmonious inconceivable.
Well, because it's inconceivable, it can't be conceived anyway. But it's, yeah.
So that's not even your experience. Mm. You're saying, even if we don't know it, I think I heard you say that the mind that says, I can't do it, I'm not doing it, I don't understand this practice, is also in accord
with
the mind, and it's actually an expression of the mind.
Exactly. It must be, right? It must be, because this is part of the trust, is that there's the interdependent universe, there's nothing outside it. There's nothing accepted by definition. And maybe this is something to investigate, if that makes no sense at all, right? Is that so? You know, is that really so? That everything in accord means, that everything actually just is the way it is according to conditions each moment, right? The technical term is dependent co-arising. Everything is interdependently arising according to conditions. In the whole universe, all the birth and death and the war and the love and all of it together wrapped up into one inconceivable ball of light, right? And this is, but to trust that actually nothing could be outside of that. And say, well, so the question is about experiencing it. Almost like on some level, I think we all kind of know this. That's my trust, actually, is that on some deep level, we all have some inkling of this, right? And then our rational mind kicks in and says, like, well, no, I can't go along with that, because if I do, everything will fall apart, and I won't stop the war, and all these other things, right? If I just surrender to the interdependent perfection, in a way, of the moment, according to conditions. And this, how I understand this, according to conditions, is that there's no, nothing can go wrong according to conditions, right? Everything arises due to conditions, and there's nothing but conditions. So, and to trust that deeply is this freedom from dissatisfaction. And you know, when I say nothing can go wrong, I sense like, well, it's a dangerous statement too, right? Because, well, then does like anything go? And in a sense, yeah, anything goes, right? But I think the thing is, if we're really in accord with this is again my trust, if we're really in accord with that with everything goes, then in the conventional world of harm and benefit and so on, that actions will be in accord with benefit at the time that we trust this accord. Do you follow that? But this is a big barrier, I think, potential barrier. It's like, well, I'm not going to trust it until I know it's in accord, or that my actions will be in accord if I just surrender like that. So then we don't really surrender. Yes. Well, in the Chinese term, it's that character xin is translated as trust or faith, which in English I think have very different sense. Or for me, they have a different sense. Maybe they're not. My different sense is that faith, I think of like blind faith, or like faith that just like, without really knowing something, I have faith in it, but like, it's different from conviction. I think trust is more like conviction or confidence, or not quite knowing. Knowing is a little bit like the thinking mind, maybe, but doesn't like conviction sound different than faith? Almost opposites in a way in English. That's how. No? You think they're similar?
I think conviction and faith are both equally illusionary. They imply someone who's clinging, like in a hurricane, to a palm tree. They imply a hard-headedness. And a kind of a fearful hard-headedness on that illusionary idea itself.
Well, I think this could be the case, and I think this is an example of how these words like conviction and faith and so on, we all hear them according to our conditioning in slightly different ways, right? So for some people, faith might be just the right word. And for some people, conviction is, hard-headed holding or something. But so I think it really depends on the context that we've heard those words in the past and so on. But what is that trust of a Buddha that's like, the Buddha has no doubt, for example, right? But it's not a hard-headed, hard-headedness, but that's almost the definition of the first, according to, sort of scripturally, these different stages of awakening and in the early teachings, the kind of first stage part of it is the end of doubt. There's no more doubt about the path or about awakening and so on. And also in Zen, we talk about the great doubt. So there's this, that sort of sounds like something else, but I think that's not contradictory. Or it could even be said to be that the great doubt is a practice, that culminates in no doubt.
So much of what you've talked about tonight has to do with investigating.
Investigating, oh, yes. Yes. Yes.
Everything is investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And if everything is investigation, it comes out to the best beginning teaching for that with these big doubts and enlightenment. That's how
Yeah. Investigate, I think Dogen says something like, investigate to the point of no investigation, then everyone celebrates the day Bodhidharma came from the West. So investigate to the point of no investigation, where actually, or you could say doubt until the point of no doubt.
Yes.
But yeah, and it's a tricky one because we want, doubt is, I mean, I'm kind of a doubting type, I think, so doubt is really painful kind of affliction sometimes. It's also one of the hindrances to meditation is doubt, like, am I meditating right? Or like, maybe I should try this other technique today. And, you know, it's like, you can't ever do it if you just like, see, temporarily give up doubt is one of the hindrances, but then I think we can't, we can't pretend to let go of doubt. I think we have to, you know, maybe it temporarily dissolves a little bit, and then, but if it comes back, we can't say, no, forget, I'm done with doubt. I think if it arises on its own, we have to like, nope, there's more to investigate. I have to keep, you know, to the end. Yes.
So that's the thing.
But then do we have doubt that that's true? Maybe.
Yeah.
Right?
You said by scripture, by the teaching.
By the scripture, but also, yeah, by definition, but also through investigation. And I think, and the Buddha also taught, which is, I think, one of the most wonderful things about the Buddha Dharma that I was telling Henry on the way down, how much I appreciate that teaching of the Buddha, where he says, don't take my word for any of this. Isn't that so great?
What he's saying is no scripture.
Yeah, no scripture. And even him talking at that time, as well as other scriptures of any religion or anything, it's like, don't believe anything, basically. Check it out. Investigate for yourself. I mean, this is so, I think, rare for any religion to as part of the scripture, just say don't trust scriptures. But yet they're these amazing tools, right? They're aids for investigation. They're aids for personal investigation. But yeah. Yeah, so Zazen can, I think, for people who are used to following your breath for many years, for example, it may be helpful or maybe interesting to try to actually turn towards this other practice, actually. It's almost like you have to let go of the breath. And the breath is so wonderful, a settling, concentrating practice. But once settled and concentrated, to turn the mind in this more active way, to start looking, so who is this person that's meditating right now? Who is this? Not just like it's me, like who do, at its very core, who is this?
Who is asking the question?
Who is asking the question, yeah, and it's endless, and then like, who asked that? And like, and then, and then maybe even, I see. And like, well, then who sees? You know. Yeah. So there's no end to that investigation. And it may change. Who this is, or our understanding of who this is may change. Does anyone have the slightest doubt about about any reasons for practicing?
Still working on it. Investigating.
Mm-hmm. The
But I'm here.
Yeah, exactly. You're here. If you if you stop disappearing from here and you say, forget this ridiculous practice, then we need to consciously remember. Like that turtle coming across the hole in the wood, blind in the night in the ocean. Okay, we'll give the blind turtle a break and we'll say, during the daytime. Yeah. Blind turtle can look around in the daytime too. Give him some sunlight. So thank you for practicing with me tonight. Beings are numberless. Surpassable.